I'm Monica Lopez, and this week on Making Contact. Police encounters during a mental health crisis have a greater chance of turning deadly if you're Black. In this episode, 70 Million reporter Janae Darden looks at how folks in Northern California are trying to reimagine crisis response services. Here's their host, Mitzi Miller.
One in three people in federal and state prisons and 4 out of 10 people in jails have a mental illness. What's more than 1 in 5 people fatally shot by police have a mental illness, according to a years-long database compiled by the Washington Post. These may be among the reasons activists and government leaders are pushing to bar police officers from responding to mental health crises. They're putting forward new alternatives for answering these calls. Janae Darden reports from Northern California, where this idea is being put to the test.
Miles was like just a beautiful person. He was loving, thoughtful, just super sweet.
Tawn Hall grins as she sits in her sunny home office. She tells me how her son Miles loved his family and being a big brother to his younger sister.
He had the biggest smile. Like some of our neighbors called him Smiles.
Miles had his challenges too. Tawn says after he turned 18, doctors diagnosed Miles with schizoaffective disorder, a condition with a combination of mood disorder symptoms like depression or mania, and schizophrenia symptoms like hallucinations or delusions. Like so many families with loved ones who have severe mental health challenges, Tawn says they struggle to get support for Miles.
We had really worked so hard to try to get Miles help with his mental health condition, and we just kept running into roadblocks. I went to NAMI, National Alliance of Mental Illness, to take classes because I could see that his mental health was declining.
NAMI suggested she connect with the local police department. Tawn followed their suggestion for Miles' safety.
We live in a more affluent white neighborhood, and we're African-American family.
Walnut Creek, where the Hall family lives, is nearly 75% white and just 2% Black. One Yale study found that police kill Black people at more than 2.5 times the rate of white people.
And we want to make sure that, you know, they knew who Miles was, that he grew up here for 18 years and he belonged in this neighborhood. So that was like my first contact that I had made was with the police. And that's just because his behavior, he was thinking he was Jesus.
Tawn alerted a police officer through a non-emergency line.
And she actually did get calls. She did say, oh, yeah, I actually have gotten calls today about someone coming to their door.
Tawn made a relationship with the police officer, who she says connected her with a mental health social worker to help Miles with job, housing, and disability assistance. In 2018, Miles had another mental health episode, which led to an involuntary hospitalization. After his release and after taking medication, the family noticed a transformation. He was adjusting well enough to get a job and to start dating someone.
So we saw like night and day what medication looked like for someone. You know, he was doing really well.
Then, about 8 months later, his mental health started to decline again. Tawn says she looked into conservatorship, where she would have been able to compel him into treatment. But Miles was an adult now.
My son didn't understand he was sick. So he wasn't trying to get any assistance or help because he was just fine in his eyes.
He started back knocking on neighbors' doors, believing he was Jesus.
So that's when, again, we resumed our relationship with the police. I had, you know, let them know, hey, Miles is escalating. I had called the non-emergency line the day before, you know, just to let them know, hey, you know, it looks like he's going to have another mental health, you know, episode. I just want you guys to know so you can support him in his mental health crisis. There's no one else right now to be able to get to help him that way.
Tawn was right, and the following day on June 2nd, 2019, Miles did have a mental health emergency. He walked around the neighborhood with a gardening tool neighbors had given him, a long steel pole for digging. Tawn says because Miles thought he was Jesus, he saw the tool as a staff. He broke a window at the family home with the tool. neighbors and Miles's family called 911.
Yes, I'm calling to report my grandson is trying to break into the house. I need someone here right away.
We have a caller from inside of that residence. She's stating she's the grandmother and the grandson is having a mental breakdown.
Tawn calmly spoke to the 911 dispatcher.
We need to have police at our house.
What's police, happening
35.
There?
He's being violent. He broke our sliding glass window and he's threatening us with it. He has like this long pole and he's with a metal pole and he's threatening us with it. But we left the house. And he has mental health issues.
When four officers arrived, Miles ran toward them with the tool at his side. Tawn says he was trying to run back home, not necessarily toward the police.
He wasn't, you know, brandishing it, trying to, like, attack the officers.
According to Walnut Creek Police, one officer shot several small beanbags at Miles.
Beanbag, stop, stop!
Miles kept running. Then two other officers used handguns. Four rounds hit Miles, killing him steps from his home. He was 23.
His death in the middle of a sunny day and on a big cul-de-sac wasn't warranted. You know, people need to give him time and distance. And they didn't do that. And they came with guns blazing within 30 seconds. That is unacceptable. Those officers are supposed to be trained in de-escalation. And they overreacted.
The Treatment Advocacy Center, a national nonprofit organization, reports that people with untreated mental illnesses are 16 times more likely to be killed by law enforcement. And even when a mental health crisis call doesn't end up in the worst of scenarios, people with a mental illness are incarcerated, end up with a criminal record, and don't get the help they need. Advocates say part of the problem is some officers don't know how to help because they don't all have training.
Whether officers are required to go through mental health training can really depend state to state.
Shannon Scully is Senior Manager of Criminal Justice Policy at National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI.
It can also vary community to community. Some law enforcement departments have implemented their own policies around having and implemented their own programs to have a specific group of officers or all officers trained in a mental health crisis response. Some states, such as the state of Massachusetts, have taken action to require all law enforcement to be trained in something similar to CIT.
CIT, or Crisis Intervention Team, is a training developed in 1988 following the killing of 27-year-old Joseph Dwayne Robinson by Memphis police. He was suicidal and harming himself with a knife when he brandished it at police. They shot him multiple times. Officers in CIT training learn basic information about mental health, de-escalation techniques, and hear from family members, people with lived experience, and mental health professionals. NAMI members and affiliates have served on CIT's board and advised the program. The Department of Justice also has its own toolkit and national curriculum for police departments to tailor to their jurisdictions.
Both the national curriculum as well as CIT International's guidance on providing training include opportunities for law enforcement to interface with people with mental health conditions, and it really kind of helps to break down that stigma.
But some researchers say these types of trainings are inadequate and outdated, and officers who do participate in trainings may not be required to take refresher courses. And one huge problem that Shannon points out, there's not enough data on the effectiveness of these trainings.
While there has been a lot of promotion of law enforcement training, there is a significant lack in evaluation of what has an impact in some of these trainings. What are the outcomes that we see for officers who are going through these trainings and whether that training that they're receiving is connecting to having positive outcomes on the other end?
How did we get to a place as a country where law enforcement is the answer to every single social ill? I mean, your neighbor drops milk in your driveway and your first instinct is to call 911.
Kat Brooks is an activist and co-founder of the Anti-Police Terror Project, or APTP, a Black-led multiracial collective of activists that started in Oakland. Her organization has publicly advocated for Miles Hall's family and other people of color who died by police violence.
And we were responding to state terror, not just here in Oakland, but to police murders that were happening across the country.
For the last 8 years, APTP has been working on ways for communities to support themselves and provide non-police alternatives to issues of harm or public safety.
As APTP's reputation grew and as the call to not call the police grew, the onus became on us then to provide something else, because then the people started calling us. They were like, well, okay, we're not going to call law enforcement, we're going to call you. And so we were like, well, we better get our stuff together. We better get it together quickly.
So they formed their own grassroots service.
All right. Hello. My name is Asantua.
APTP co-founder Asantua Boykin welcomes more than 80 people to this virtual day-long training for Mental Health First, or MH First. They are community first responders to mental health crises who provide peer support, de-escalation assistance, and what they call life-affirming interventions, or interventions where people in crisis have a say in what they need.
I just want to thank y'all for spending your Sunday with us. You could be anywhere. And then also just thank you for spending your Sunday committed to learning how to help, committed to supporting your community members.
MH First started in 2020 in Sacramento, the state capital, where Santua is now based. And there's a second operation in Oakland. Between the two cities, MH First says they have over 200 volunteers and that 700 people have taken their training so far. Asantua is a registered nurse. Most of her 17-year career in healthcare has been in mental health.
So we examined some other trainings. I've taken several trainings myself. And I think one thing that sets us apart is, one, the political ideology that we come from that I haven't seen in other trainings, where our goal is to prevent that police contact. And we're really upfront about that.
The MH First training reflects this, covering not just how to engage with someone in psychosis or administering Narcan to someone overdosing on opioids. They also go over how historical oppression like colonization and systemic racism affects people's mental health, the criminalization of people with mental illness, and what's called cop watching, which is documenting and observing police response to emergencies and making sure they're not violating the rights of the person in crisis. MH First volunteers are available on weekend nights. They answer calls, texts, and direct messages to their social media. Asantua tells me Oakland volunteers get 30 to 40 contacts a month, many related to homelessness. Sacramento receives less interactions.
We've had shifts where we got no calls, and then some shifts we get like 7 or 8. So it just depends on the really what's going on in the world.
More bad news in the world equates to more calls.
Right, like at the brink of COVID, phone was like ringing off the hook. Around the Capitol insurrection, there was a lot of calls.
Callers may have seen MH First hotline numbers on billboards. Those in need, family members, or witnesses to a crisis can call or text the hotline number for help.
Hi, you've reached Mental Health First. This is V speaking. Would you like to share your name?
V Rebello is an MH First volunteer in Oakland. I asked her to walk me through a hypothetical call for someone whose PTSD was triggered.
First, we would want to try to control and calm the breath a little bit so you can feel safer. And then we always want to follow the caller's lead as well. So I'd probably ask you some questions about what it is that you want or what you need or how we can best support you. So once we're able to be in a slightly calmer state, then we can both have a little more mental capacity to maybe do some problem solving or brainstorming.
V herself has lived with her own mental health challenges and worked as a peer counselor in college. MH First volunteers tend to have that personal experience, whether it's with a family member, friend, or themselves. She says MH First is built on this idea of healing justice.
A healing justice framework means that we need to build support systems and institutions that are designed and led by people who know what it's like to go through these harmful institutions, who've been in crisis themselves, who've actually had to support other people in crisis with the goal of healing rather than further contributing to harm.
BIPOC communities face hurdles in receiving mental health care. It's expensive if you don't have insurance. You might have trouble accessing resources if English isn't your first language. Finding a therapist who understands your culture can be challenging. The American Psychology Association says that in 2015, 86% of working psychologists were white. Since programs like MH First are responding to these emergencies, often without police present, I ask Asantua about the possibility of volunteers ending up in violent situations.
Most of our calls have nothing to do with violence. And a larger part of our work is dispelling the stigmatization that being in mental health crisis automatically equals violence. In the instance of extreme violence, likely we were not the people that were called, right? Likely someone has called 911 or used some other mechanism to intervene in that violence.
U.S. government data shows that most people with mental illnesses are not violent. Actually, those with severe mental illnesses are over 10 times more likely to be victims of a violent crime than the general population. Asantua says in her experience, many MH First callers are looking for mental health resources. Parents call about their kids who are showing early symptoms of mental health issues. And some callers just need to talk.
Because I know there's some folks, part of their symptoms is being hyperverbal. And in other settings, that's not appropriate. No one's going to listen to you for an hour. Right? They don't have the time. But for us, we do. Right? We do. We can listen.
Due to COVID, MH First volunteers are mostly doing phone support right now. But part of the model is responding in person if necessary.
That way, if someone does need a wellness check, or if law enforcement officers are on a scene and there's some type of crisis or potential mental health concern, we would be able to show up.
Intervention can take different forms, from bringing someone food or supplies to de-escalating a conflict. Here's Asantua again.
One of the things that I've done over and over again is just really like isolate, right? Like get the person off their front lawn and into their backyard, where it's less likely that the police are going to be called, like if they're behaving erratically, right? Like, or getting someone out of the street, right? Who might be like walking around in the street. I think of one time there was a young lady who was doing that kind of and out of traffic. And we just got her settled somewhere she felt safe. We asked her, does she want to go to the hospital? Even though she wasn't completely lucid, she was lucid when she said no about that. And so we got her settled and got her some food, and we waited until she drifted off to sleep. And then we did what we came to do.
But what happens if the person is in extreme psychosis and it's affecting their own safety?
If that psychosis is limiting one's ability to be safe, and it is very, very apparent to us, right? Actions that we've taken are what we call a warm handoff.
That's when a patient is handed off from one person administering care to another. It's done in person and with family if they're available. This keeps the communication open and the patient engaged. MH First has also transported people to the hospital or handed them over to the ER. Asantua says, when MH First has shown up to an emergency where there's also a law enforcement response, the police have been cooperative.
Police largely don't want to be doing this specific kind of work. So to our surprise, they've been accommodating, but they've been largely obliged, you know, just, oh yeah, you're the person that needs to be here. Go ahead and talk to this person, and have gotten good outcomes when it comes to our contact and our crisis intervention with the participants.
But even with alternatives like MH First available, the majority of crisis calls are still going to 911. This is why APTP, along with other advocates, have been calling for the city of Oakland to have a mental health emergency service. They talked to local leaders and city council members, but Kat Brooks says they didn't get any traction.
We were laughed out of rooms, and nobody cared or nobody was listening.
Until recently. Support from organizers and city council members led to a new government-funded mental health emergency response program called MACRO, Mobile Assistance Community Responders of Oakland. It's modeled after CAHOOTS in Eugene, Oregon, which is also a mobile crisis response service. They've been around since 1989. When Eugene residents call CAHOOTS' non-emergency police line, a crisis intervention worker and EMT are dispatched. And in Oakland, instead of the police, civilians with mental health and/or medical training will be dispatched for some non-emergency and mental health calls. Kat Brooks has big expectations for MACRO.
I hope that it's transformative and not performative, right? This is not just about exchanging bodies, right? It's not just about exchanging police officers with social workers. This is about decolonizing the way that we look at mental health and how we talk about and implement public safety. I hope that it provides living wage jobs for Black and Brown people. I hope it humanizes the human condition of mental health crisis and changes the way we treat our beloved community members.
MACRO passed unanimously in Oakland City Council this past spring. For now, the fire department will oversee the 18-month pilot program. They hope to launch no later than February 2022. It's rolling out first in West and East Oakland.
This program is greatly needed in Oakland because when you look at the 911 calls that Oakland police receive every day, they cannot attend to them now.
City Council Member Noel Gallo represents a heavily Latino East Oakland district facing high rates of homelessness, drug use, and violence.
I was complaining to the police chief yesterday because many residents are complaining that they're calling 911 and the police are not showing up. Or when then they show up, and it's too late.
A 2019 report found that nearly 40% of callers to Oakland's 911 dispatch were not answered within 15 seconds, the standard in California. Over 18,000 callers had to wait over 2 minutes to speak to someone. And with historical tensions between police and Black and Brown communities, like in his district, Gallo says he's glad that the fire department will be overseeing the pilot program.
So when the firefighter responds to the individual that's on the street, on the sidewalk, dealing with violence as well, I see that difference in behavior in terms of the cooperation with the individual on the street, cooperating to, you know, get into the ambulance and be delivered for services, whether it's, you know, health-wise and so forth. But when I see the police officer respond to that 911 call, you know, the behavior's different. You know, the individual's more confrontational and gonna handcuff me, throw me in.
With a police department where about 90% of officers do not live in Oakland, Gallo says having mental health trained responders from the community will make a difference.
You know, our goal is to be able to hire and train individuals from the neighborhood, hopefully, that would understand my communication and how I live, and also, you know, just the response that I need and not be a confrontational.
Go deeper into East Oakland, and the concerns are the same. City Council Member Lauren Taylor represents another high-need neighborhood.
So my district and the one closest to us, we are responsible for 2/3 of the calls for 911 in the city. We have the disproportionately higher number of homicides.
Crime, lack of resources, homelessness, and COVID are affecting the mental health of Taylor's constituents.
Across the board, I think all of our responders need to have a general awareness, sensitivity, and understanding of how mental health across the spectrum plays into how people show up, especially at times of crisis and emergency.
Taylor supports MACRO. But he says this is a bigger problem than just who to call in an emergency.
Yeah, so MACRO is not the panacea that's going to solve everything, right? But what it is doing is it's addressing the first line of response. That being said, when it comes to official sort of mental health practitioners that are able to really assess, diagnose, and treat more severe mental illnesses and mental health conditions, that is not what MACRO is set up to do at this point. I've had conversations with the community health practitioners, and they point to, yes, this is an entire system issue when we talk about mental health.
While Taylor reflects on the system in his own district, there are people looking at this on a national scale.
The question is, will the House suspend the rules and pass Senate Bill 2661? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
Last year, with bipartisan support, Congress passed the National Suicide Hotline Designation Act. It creates a new number, 988, that anyone from anywhere in the country can call if they're in any mental health crisis. Calls are routed to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline or the Veterans Crisis Line. 988 is an easier number to remember and will replace the National Suicide Hotline's 10-digit number. 988 doesn't go into effect until July 2022. Until then, the current national 800 number is still the number to call. In the meantime, states are working to set up 988 systems in their own jurisdictions. Here's Shannon Scully of NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness.
What the Designation Act did, it not only designated 988 as the three-digit number, you know, for mental health crisis and suicide, it also created a mechanism in which the states are allowed to pass their own bills that would levy a fee to fund services related to 988.
With this new act, states can add a fee to cell phone bills to help fund 988 services. And if they choose, establish their own mental health crisis centers that provide help with any mental health issue, not just suicidal thoughts. States can establish dispatch services too. Shannon says NAMI is advocating for states to have a three-pronged system in place when setting up a crisis response.
If you are struggling, what we want to see is that you have someone to talk to, you have someone to respond, and you have somewhere to go.
NAMI's vision, Shannon says, social workers, mental health professionals, and advocates who are dispatched to callers instead of law enforcement, and crisis respite centers for people to further de-escalate and continue to receive support. This may be an option for families with loved ones in crisis, like Miles Hall's.
I, as a family member, can potentially dial 988 for help and start accessing and seeking supportive services that exist in my community. That's the type of other crises that we're really working to make sure get addressed so that they don't have to receive a law enforcement response, that they are receiving an appropriate mental health response.
Shannon points to states like Colorado, Nevada, and Washington that have already passed bills that include a tax to fund their own response systems. But she says other states are still just exploring ideas for what resources and services they need.
We know that there's a lot of conversations happening nationally, state level, county level, city level, about how is 911 going to interface with 988? How do we make sure that people know that 988 exists? How can we loop our existing mental health system, again, into 988? And there are probably hundreds, if not thousands, of conversations that are happening on a regular basis as we speed towards July of next year.
Here in California, Tawn Hall is advocating for AB 988, the Miles Hall Lifeline Act.
Something like the Miles Hall Lifeline Act, AB 988, would have potentially saved his life because we would have had mental health professionals responding to his medical emergency.
Under the proposed act, mobile crisis teams and peer support would be available 24/7, an alternative to contacting law enforcement. The bill is currently under review in the state Senate.
Thanks to Janae Darden for that story.
And thanks to Mitzi Miller and the 70 Million crew. You've been listening to Taking Mental Health Crises Out of Police Hands on Making Contact. For a full list of credits, check out our website at radioproject.org. I'm Monica Lopez. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.